interview and dressed in a business shirt. No tie. The shirt was ironed. He looked like a respectable member of the community. He had no legal representation. It was difficult to imagine this man having anything to do with that blood-soaked T-shirt. They were in the small, windowless ERISP room at the station. ERISP stood for Electronic Record of Interview with a Suspected Person, and it meant that this entire interview was being recorded on both an audio and video disc. Ethan sat in one corner, observing and keeping an eye on the recording equipment.
"You really want to be a cop?" his brother had said to him when he first mentioned going into the police force. "Directing traffic?"
Ethan's brother was an actuary. He was sitting in a city office right now solving mathematical equations while Ethan was helping solve a possible murder, and his brother thought he'd made the better choice of career. Christina did something quick and complicated with her hair to make it tighter at the back. She said,
"Mr. Delaney, I'd like to go through the timeline one more time."
"Okay,"
Stan nodded. He sat up, uncrossed his arms and placed closed fists on his thighs. "Bring it on," he seemed to be saying.
"What do you want to know?"
"Stan Delaney is formidable on the court," one of his fellow club members had told Christina and Ethan,
a man who was keen to let them know that he believed Stan had buried his wife's body under their tennis court.
"He's ruthless, calculating, ferocious. He gets this look on his face that makes your blood run cold."
Christina looked down at her notes as if to check them, although Ethan knew for a fact that she knew the timeline by heart.
"You woke up that morning, Valentine's Day, and you didn't see your wife?"
Ethan had been intimidated by Detective Christina Khoury when he first started working with her. He thought she thought he was a moron. She had a way of looking at him as if she were sizing him up and finding him wanting. But he'd got used to that look now. She gave the same look to her morning coffee each day, and she loved her coffee. Ethan's aunt said that he and his brother were intimidated by women because they were subconsciously terrified of displeasing them due to the fact their mother had walked out when they were little kids. Ethan and his brother both agreed that was total crap. They didn't say this to their aunt's face, of course.
"We were sleeping in separate rooms."
Stan answered Christina's question with steady eyes.
"Was that a new development?" asked Christina. "Relatively new, yes."
She checked her notes.
"And you went out to buy milk first thing in the morning?"
"Yes," said Stan. "We were out of milk. I also bought the paper."
"Right," said Christina. "And you came home, but you didn't see Mrs. Delaney."
"Not right away. I was reading something in my office."
That was new.
"Reading what?"
Ethan leaned forward. So did Christina.
"What were you reading?"
"Just some paperwork."
"What sort of paperwork?" Stan shrugged.
"Nothing of importance."
Ethan saw the lie, and he knew Christina saw it too. He watched her wait. She was still. He wondered if her heart was racing like his. Stan said nothing. Perhaps his was the fastest racing heart in this small room.
"Right," said Christina after a moment. "So you were reading this paperwork and then you heard the front door?"
"Yes," said Stan. "I don't know where she'd been, but I heard her come in and then I went to talk to her in the kitchen. She was drinking a glass of water. She seemed worked up about something."
"And that's when you argued?"
"That's right."
"About what?"
He crossed his arms again, defensive.
"It was just an ordinary argument between a husband and wife."
Considering the fact that your wife left your home and has now been missing for nearly 3 weeks, I'd say this was more than an ordinary argument between a husband and wife, Mr. Delaney. For the first time, Ethan heard aggression in her voice, a hint of something bigger and more menacing beneath it, like a quick glimpse of a shark's fin. But Stan didn't even blink. Christina said, "So that morning after this ordinary argument, you left the house and you didn't come back until what time?" "Around 10 o'clock that night, like I've told you many times now." "And where did you go that day?" "I just drove, like I've told you many times." "You just drove?" "I was upset." "What about?" Ethan could see Stan's frustration rising like boiling water, which was exactly what Christina wanted. She was slowly turning up the temperature. "I was upset because I'd argued with my wife." "But you don't remember what you argued about." He unfolded his arms once more and leaned towards her. He was a big man. "No, that's not right. I never said that. I do remember what we argued about, but it's personal. My marriage is private. It's none of your business. It's not relevant to your investigation." It took a certain type of man to say to a police detective, "It's none of your business." Christina said, "If you're worried about your wife, perhaps you could let us determine what's relevant." Stan shrugged in the manner of his oldest son, said nothing. "So you came back and she was gone?" "Yes." "But you didn't call anyone. You didn't call a single one of your children. You didn't call a single friend. You didn't call her." He lifted his chin a fraction. "We'd argued, like I told you. I knew she was angry with me. I assumed she'd gone to stay with someone and that she'd be back the next day." "But she wasn't." "No, she wasn't," said Stan. "Was there any infidelity in your marriage?" she asked. His nostrils flared. "No." Christina flipped a page in her notebook for show. "It's my understanding your youngest daughter once caught your wife with another man at a party." "That was a long time ago. Joy drank too much punch and kissed Dennis Christos. It was hardly a great love affair. Old mate is dead now anyway. According to my wife, I killed him." Stan frowned as he realised what he'd just said. "I didn't literally kill him. He had a heart attack." He sniffed. "He should never have kissed my wife either, by the by. But as I said, that was a lifetime ago." "Grudges can last a lifetime," thought Ethan. Stan jerked his chin at Christina's notebook. "Did my daughter tell you that? About Joy kissing Dennis at the party?" "Your former son-in-law, Grant Willis." His brow cleared. "Right. Well, that makes more sense." "You mean because your daughter wants to protect you?" He said nothing. Christina said, "I'm guessing all your children want to protect you." "I don't need protection," said Stan, "because I've done nothing wrong." "The young woman who stayed with you last year," said Christina, "I believe she was a former student's younger sister. Your most famous student's sister." His face hardened. "There was no affair, if that's what you're thinking. I know that's what people have been saying. It's laughable." So it's recently come to our attention that while Savannah was staying with you, she revealed certain information. Information that I understand came as a shock to you. He squeezed his lower lip between his thumb and his finger.
Who told you that?
Christina didn't answer. Ethan watched him trying to work out which of his children had handed over a potential motive for murder. Your wife betrayed you, didn't she? She told Harry Haddad's father that he'd be better off with another coach.
I wouldn't use the word betrayed, he said.
Wouldn't you? I understand that's exactly the word you did use. They held each other's gaze. It felt perversely intimate, as if they were about to kiss. Stan Delaney's eyes, brown and dark-lashed, were young and wary in an old man's face. Was it a young man's violent rage that had been responsible for this old man's unthinkable actions?
What do you mean?
His voice quavered. He was cracking. At last. You said to your wife that you'd never felt so betrayed.
Who told you that?
Stan's jaw shifted back and forth as though he was grinding his teeth. Ethan could no longer see the young man, only the old man. An old man wondering which of his children thought he was capable of murder. I'm hearing that your wife may not have been faithful. I'm hearing that she betrayed you professionally. Christina was going in for the kill now. You lost your temper. Justifiably so. Harry Haddad could have and should have been your greatest professional success. Your wife stole that opportunity from you and kept it a secret. She pushed the Polaroid of the bloodied T-shirt across the table. Mr. Delaney, we found this T-shirt buried in bushland near the back of your house, she said. Have you seen it before? The colour drained from his face.
Buried? Repeated Stan Delaney. You think I buried Joy's T-shirt?
Did you?
No.
Do you recognise the shirt?
It's my wife's shirt. I'm sure you know that, said Stan.
He pushed the picture away from him, contemptuously, as if it meant nothing to him.
It's covered in my wife's blood. You probably know that too.
Christina's tone was now almost jocular. Mr. Delaney, this is not looking great for you. I really think it would be in your best interests to turn your mind to your last interaction with your wife. Stan sighed. He tipped back his head, stuck his thumbs in his pants pockets and studied the ceiling.
I think it might be in my best interests to shut up and get myself a lawyer.
Chapter 53, Valentine's Day. It was 7 a.m. and Joy couldn't see the point in getting out of bed. There was nothing pressing to do. It would be just another day like yesterday and the day before that. The smoke haze outside her window was as grey and sombre as a midwinter sky, except for the blood-red summer sun that burned like a cigarette end. Joy had never experienced asthma, but she had recently found herself taking small, shallow, ladylike sips of air. Was it the smoke or the state of her marriage? It had been months since Savannah had left, and it didn't feel like anything was lessening or softening. The opposite. Their anger was hardening and solidifying. She and Stan had been through bad times before. The difference was that there were no distractions now, no work, no children. When they were younger, there hadn't been time to obsess and brood over how the other person had wronged them. They'd been too tired to keep sharpening the edges of their hurt feelings. Now they were stuck in this big, empty, silent house, and there was no way to escape the invisible yet tangible conflict between them. Joy felt like she could trace its outlines in the air. January had been especially bad because of the Australian Open. Harry Haddad's comeback had crashed and burned after a shock loss. Some went as far as to say an embarrassing loss in the first round to an unseeded 19-year-old Canadian. 10 double faults and over 80 unforced errors. Harry and his new coach, Nicole Lenoir-Joudin, were parting ways. Joy hadn't watched the match, but she'd walked past the living room and seen Stan gripping the sides of his chair, crackling with so much fury and distress, it had felt like he was a live electrical wire. If she'd touched him, she'd have gone flying. Now, if one of them walked into the room and saw the other one there, they walked away again. They spoke only when necessary. They hadn't slept in the same bedroom since Savannah left. Stan slept on a mattress on the floor of Logan's old room. Amy's bedroom would have been more comfortable, but perhaps he didn't want to sleep where Savannah had slept. So, well done to him. That sure showed her. Joy bet his back hurt. She hoped it did hurt. Did that mean the love was finally gone? It seemed possible that not a droplet remained. She was as dry and desiccated as their desperate for rain front lawn. She heard the sound of water running from somewhere in the house. She'd stopped cooking after Christmas as a test to see if Stan might offer to prepare something, to put some toast in the toaster or to order takeaway. But he hadn't said a word. They were quietly feeding themselves as if they were flatmates, slipping in and out of the kitchen, polishing the bench tops, rinsing their plates, leaving behind as little evidence of their presence as possible, as if this were one of the rules of the competition. Stan appeared to be working his way through the cans of spaghetti and baked beans in the pantry. Joy mostly ate toast. Sometimes she boiled an egg. She felt fragile and shaky, exhausted and constantly on the verge of tears. It reminded her of the weeks after she'd just had a baby or lost a loved one. Joy didn't know how Stan was spending his days. He seemed to be doing something in his office. When she walked past, she caught glimpses of him frowning over his glasses as he importantly turned the page on some paperwork, although God knew what paperwork it could have been. Joy took care of the paperwork. Divorce papers? Also, why did she call it his office? When the children were little, they always called it Daddy's office, even though Joy was the one who handled all the business of the business. Yet they all had to maintain the pretense that because Stan was the man, whatever he was doing was automatically more important and deserved priority over any contribution from the little lady. Well, fuck you, Stan. The swearing in her head was a new and satisfying development. When she was 30, she'd assumed that by this time of her life, nothing would matter all that much. Her emotions would be muted and soft as the skin of an old lady's face. The violence of her thoughts startled her and woke her up. She assumed these words would not make their way from her brain to her tongue, but you never knew. Imagine if her children heard her talk like that out loud. That would show them. She was conducting an experiment. She stopped calling her children. She was sick of the harried, impatient way they answered her calls. She was sick of being the one to organise every family event. It had now been 7 days since she had spoken to any one of her offspring. She would have assumed that her most dutiful children, Logan and or Brooke, would have checked in by now. But no. Hypothesis? My children don't care. Conclusion? My children don't care. Her friends were quiet and busy with their own lives too. Caro had her daughter Petra visiting from Copenhagen with her children. Childish laughter floated from Caro's garden into Joy's window. Caro shouldn't be letting those children play outside in this smoky air.
Two other friends had become first-time grandmothers, one baby boy, one baby girl. Joy had sent them congratulations on your grandson slash granddaughter cards. She kept a stack of them in a drawer and grimly selected the correct gender each time she got the happy news. She tried to work out what to do with her day. Her eyes traced a horrible brownish stain on the bedroom ceiling. She'd never noticed it before. It looked like blood, but she knew it was just rainwater from a long-ago storm. It hadn't rained in forever. She must get up. She didn't move. Her hands clutched at the fitted sheet. Come on, Joy. Two of her fingernails were broken and kept getting caught irritatingly against the sheet. She couldn't find the nail scissors, even though she knew she'd bought a new pair just 2 weeks ago. Her fingernails broke so easily now, like elderly bones, like her elderly heart. She was not elderly. She wasn't even 70. Before Christmas, she'd beaten a 50-year-old, a good player, 6'4", 6'2". But she hadn't been back to the club this year. She didn't seem to have the energy. She did not feel suicidal, absolutely not. But for the first time ever, she found herself thinking that maybe she'd had enough. It wasn't worth the bother anymore. She wanted her grandparents. She wanted her mother. She imagined their faces lighting up when she walked through the arrival gates of the afterlife. It would be nice to see them again. She would run into their arms. She'd have to wear something nice for her mother. Today was Valentine's Day, a day that celebrated love. She and Stan had never really taken much notice of Valentine's Day. It was an American holiday, but every year there seemed to be more fuss about it, red roses and chocolates and teddy bears, men in suits carrying bouquets. Joy didn't want red roses, but she would like a husband who still shared her bed. She rolled over onto her stomach and pressed her face into her pillow. If she started crying, she might never stop. Get up, she said into the pillow. Get up now. She thought of her mother describing a morning when Joy was a baby. Beautiful, no-nonsense Pearl Becker woke up one morning and couldn't get out of bed. She could barely lift her head from her pillow. It was like I had blocks of concrete tied to me, she told Joy. When she heard the milkman at the front door, those were the days, she called out to him to please get help, and so the doctor came around to examine her. The doctor doing a house visit. Those sure were the days. The doctor said she probably had some kind of vitamin deficiency and told her that she needed to get up and be strong for her baby. Of course, those weren't really the days, because now, with the benefit of modern knowledge, any layperson would diagnose her mother's depression, although Pearl refused to accept that. Oh, no, it was something physical, Joy. I had nothing to be sad about, she said. I had you, a beautiful baby. You would have looked better if you didn't have that big round head, as bald as a cue ball, but you were a sweet little thing. Her mother specialised in the tiny, razor-sharp dig wrapped in a soft compliment, so you didn't notice the blood until afterwards. And I had a handsome husband. That was before the handsome husband went off to meet a friend and never returned. Joy's limbs felt as heavy as perhaps her mother's had felt that long ago morning, yet her heart raced. Was this a glimpse of depression coupled with anxiety? Was this how Amy suffered? A dull ache crept across her forehead. She never got headaches. The universe must have decided it was time she experienced what both her daughters endured. Why had her daughters had to suffer these invisible illnesses that no one seemed to understand? Might I suggest a firmer hand?
said their family GP with a droll wag of his finger in Amy's face. And then, is this one a bit of a hypochondriac, maybe? Baby of the family? Likes the attention? He'd winked at Joy over the top of Brooke's pain-stricken, dead-white face. Another daughter's eyes begging Joy for relief she couldn't give. It was easy when she took the boys to see him. Their illnesses were masculine, visible and curable. Coughs and blocked noses, rashes and broken bones. The GP didn't know what he didn't know about mental health and migraines. Even the specialists didn't seem to know much more, and they were even more expensive and patronising. But why had Joy been so polite in the face of their ignorance, so meek and grateful? Thank you, Doctor. I'm sure you're right, Doctor. And then she'd get back in the car with a miserable daughter beside her, and the girls misinterpreted her frustration at her own impotence as anger at them, and they blamed themselves, just as she blamed herself. That GP was dead now. So was at least one of those specialists, as far as she knew. Useless rage directed at long since dead men propelled her out of bed and into the shower. She gathered and stoked the rage as she showered. There was only her shampoo and body wash in the shower stall now. No evidence of a husband. Stan was using the other bathroom. Perhaps it was time to finally accept defeat on this marriage. To meet at the net, shake hands, clap each other respectfully on the shoulder, wave to the fans, and walk away. She scrubbed her head hard. Her broken fingernails gouged her scalp. She thought of all the truisms she and Stan had passed on to their children and their students. You can still fight back from match point down. If you want to overcome a losing streak, you reevaluate your game. She was a fighter. She was a winner. She was Joy Delaney. She would not give up on this marriage. She would take decisive, aggressive action today. She would make apple crumble. That's what she'd do. Stan might at times be obtuse, but he would understand the symbolism of Joy making his mother's signature dish. She would try out Savannah's suggestion. There was a bottle of whiskey in the back of the pantry. She took 2 Panadol for her headache. She brushed her teeth for twice as long as usual. She blow-dried her hair using the big round brush Narelle said she should use, but that she avoided because it made her wrist ache. She put on a flattering dress, one that Stan had once lavishly described as very nice. Lipstick. She walked out of the bedroom feeling peculiarly self-conscious. The house was silent. Was he even here? Stan, she called out. Her voice cracked. Surely he would answer her. Stan? No answer. She walked to the front room, pulled back the curtain. The car was gone. He was out early. She wondered where. Well, it was stupid to feel hurt that he had not told her he was going out, because this was the way they were living right now. But still, her heart felt newly hurt, as tender and soft as bruised fruit. She went to the kitchen, put the jug on for a cup of tea, and opened the refrigerator to get out the apples for the crumble. She'd bought 5 plump green Granny Smith apples when she was in the shops on Thursday, but now there was only 1 left, rolling about sadly in the crisper. Stan had managed to eat 4 apples in 2 days. She considered going back to bed and aborting the mission. No. She rallied. She would pop down to the mini-mart by the railway station and pick up some more. They always opened early. Except Stan had the car, and it would take forever to walk there. She made a low, growling sound of frustration. Steffi, who was lying in her favourite cool spot by the back door, lifted her head inquiringly, her tail thumping against the floor. I'm trying, Steffi, said Joy. It's just that he's eaten all the apples and taken the car. Inspiration struck. She would change into shorts and ride her brand new bike to the mini mart. So far, she had only been for one little spin around the cul-de-sac. She loved the idea of the bike, but she was actually a bit nervous about traffic. She would face her fears. It was exhilarating to face your fears, or so everyone said. Half an hour later, she stood on trembling legs in the mini-mart, plunking down the money for four overpriced Granny Smith apples. She was friendly, as usual, to the mini-mart man, even though he scowled at her, as usual. Why did he hate her so? She placed the apples in her wicker basket and began the ride home. She had to really work the pedals to get up the hill. In all the years she'd lived here, she'd never noticed the Mount Everest-like incline of this particular street. Someone beeped their horn, making her heart leap. The bike swerved and the front wheel banged violently against the gutter. She straightened the handles, turned the corner, looked down and saw that the front tire was completely flat. For goodness sake, what next? She threw the bike to the ground, hard, like a child. She stood, hands on hips, breathing heavily, looking at the bike and the apples. She kicked one of the apples like a ball. It rolled a listless, short distance. She was not going to make an apple crumble today. Or ever again. So that was the end of that. You can choose the right shot, you can have a good swing and good technique, you can do everything right, and it can still go wrong. No player, no matter how good, makes 100% of their shots. Some days you lose. They drummed that into the children too. You can be number one in the world. You can win and win and win, but it's inevitable. Eventually, you will lose. She walked the rest of the way home, carrying her helmet by the strap. The car was in the driveway. She would go back and collect the bike once she'd calmed and cooled down. Inside, the house was silent, but she could still feel the skulking, sulking presence of her husband. Her shirt stuck to her sweaty body, and her mood flared as scratchy and hissy as Caro's awful thieving cat. She went to the kitchen, got herself a glass of water, and drank deeply.
"You should probably read this."
Stan's voice, suddenly so deep and loud behind her, made her jump. The glass banged painfully against her teeth. She turned to look at him. He threw some kind of bound document onto the table. "What is it?" she said.
"It's Harry Haddad's memoir," said Stan. "This is a preview copy, I think you call it. He sent it to us to read. I'm in it. We're both in it."
"Right," she said. She almost said, "whatever," like a teenager. She'd forgotten all about that damned memoir. It didn't matter now. The ugly little secret was out.
"He admits he used to cheat when he played as a kid," said Stan.
He tapped his finger on the document. She read the title, "Game to Harry."
"He admits it?"
She put the glass down and slowly sank into a chair at the table, pulling Harry's life story towards her. If Harry was publicly admitting that he once cheated, then it must have been more than a few bad calls.
"Yes," said Stan. "It's not that surprising."
"I beg your pardon?" She looked up at him. She couldn't believe he would say that. "What do you mean, it's not surprising? You didn't believe Troy. You accused him of lying."
"I did not," said Stan. "I never said he lied. I told him it was an unfortunate reality of the game. I told him he would sometimes face kids who made bad calls and that he shouldn't focus on his opponent but on his own game."
"Rubbish."
She wanted to grab the back of his head and force him to look in the right direction where he could see his past clearly. You took Harry's side. You didn't support your own son.
My son assaulted another player. Of course I didn't support him. Are you crazy?
Don't you dare call me crazy.
She was electrified with rage, against her husband, against those long-ago doctors who couldn't help her daughters, against the rude mini-mart man. Her hair did not look nice right now. It was all flat and sweaty, and her legs still wobbled from that bike ride up Mount Bloody Everest from her failed mission to get apples to make her horrible husband's nasty mother's apple crumble. Troy lost his temper because he didn't have your support.
Troy was given every opportunity. They were all given every opportunity. They have no idea how lucky they were.
She felt the criticism of her children like a physical blow.
They played their hearts out.
He didn't listen. His mind was still on Harry. His mind had always been on Harry. Harry's talent, Harry's potential. Harry, Harry, Harry.
Do you want to know why that poor kid cheated?
He roared. He picked up the bound document and shook it violently at her.
Because his father told him his sister had cancer.
The words jolted Joy, like a change in direction so sudden it could rupture an Achilles tendon. She thought she already knew everything that Stan had to say in this argument. She said faintly,
"He told him Savannah had cancer?" "Like father, like daughter."
He smiled with grim satisfaction, as if he'd predicted exactly this bizarre outcome, and pushed the manuscript across the table towards her.
"He told Harry that he had to win prize money so his sister could get some kind of life-saving medicine. Dumb kid thought he was playing to save his sister's life. No wonder he cheated. If he'd stayed with me, I would have found out and put a stop to it. But I never got that opportunity because you made a unilateral decision to send him away."
His hands were splayed like claws, like he wanted to strangle her. She could not think about Harry now. She focused instead on the information she'd had back then.
"Your children needed your support," she shouted back. "I needed your support. You had no right. Coaching was my profession."
Stan towered over her, and she was not frightened. She was exhilarated because the fractured shell of their marriage was finally cracking open like a coconut.
She wanted it all out. She wanted to finally say everything she'd never said. "What about my profession?"
She banged her chest with her fist.
"What about me? What about my career? My sacrifice?"
"Your sacrifice?"
His disbelief was like a public shaming. As if she had anything to sacrifice. She wasn't worth anything. Not a smile from the mini-mart man, not a phone call from her children.
"I gave up my tennis for you," she said.
Finally, she'd said it out loud. All these years it had been there, never on the tip of her tongue, not at the back of her head, but right at the centre of her chest. Beneath her collarbone, between her breasts, right where she continued to bang her fist over and over.
"What about me? What about me? What about me?"
She'd never wanted his gratitude, just his acknowledgement, just once, because otherwise what had been the point of her entire life, of all those lamb chops she'd grilled, of all that spaghetti bolognese? My God, she despised spaghetti bolognese. Night after night after night, plate after plate after plate, the laundry, the ironing, the mopping, the sweeping, the driving. She'd never resented it at the time, but now she resented every moment, every single bloody lamb chop.
He said quietly, I never asked you to give anything up, Joy.
But that was the point. He didn't have to ask her.
If you wanted it, you would have done it, he said.
The anger had gone from his voice. She could see that familiar, deathly stillness coming over him. He was removing himself from the situation, first mentally, then physically. She knew what came next, what always came next. In a moment, she'd be alone in this big silent house with her thoughts and regrets. Stan said, if you'd really wanted it, nothing would have stopped you.
She couldn't speak. Did he not see that the only thing that could have stopped her was her love for him?
Then he delivered his final damning judgment. You were never going to rank in the top 10, Joy. If I thought you could have got there, I would never have let you stop.
The air whooshed from her like a fist to the stomach. He would never have let her stop, as if her sacrifice had been his considered decision. If she had been the one to be injured, it wouldn't have occurred to him to give up his career. He was wrong, and there was no way in the world that she could go back in time and prove it to him or to herself. Instead, she reacted instinctively. You weren't good enough to coach Harry. He was better off without you. You would have held him back. He needed a better coach than you. It wasn't true. She believed Stan to be one of the best coaches in the country, maybe the world. She knew what he could have been without the tethers of a family. But didn't he know what she could have been? How far she could have flown? He put Harry's memoir back on the table. He patted the pocket of his jeans, pulled out the car keys. She dug deep for the most glittering pieces of vitriol she could find. I was the one who made Delaney's a success. Everyone knows it. If it wasn't for me, you'd have nothing. You'd be nothing but a washed-up, useless nothing. The words bounced off him. He turned to walk away, and she could not stand it. It was not fair that he got to leave. It had never been fair. It had never been right. And yet she'd endured it over and over again, and her children had endured it. And it was unacceptable, inexcusable behaviour, and she would no longer accept. She would no longer excuse. This time he would stay. She ran after him, and even as she ran, part of herself registered the shame and indignity and inappropriateness of her actions. She floated up to the skylight and observed herself, a small, sweaty senior citizen running out of her nice kitchen and down the hallway towards the front door after her husband, shouting incoherently alongside an old dog barking confusedly, trying to work out where the danger lay because there were no strangers in the house, so what could there be to fear? Joy reached for the back of her husband's checked blue and white shirt, the shirt she'd ironed, to wrench him back, to make him stay. Steffi ran in crazed, panting circles around them. Stan swung around and the dog tripped him. He lurched forward, nearly falling. One hand grabbed at the wall, causing the framed photo of Brooke with her under-8s regional trophy to swing and bang and crack. Joy's outstretched hand, clawing for his shirt, instead raked down Stan's cheek, drawing instant blood with her vicious, broken nails. He grabbed her, his fingers painful on her shoulders. She froze, because his face was no longer his. It was an unfamiliar mask of ugly rage. Her heart stopped. The world stopped. For the first time in her 69 years, she felt the fear. The fear every woman knows is always waiting for her. The possibility that lurks and scuttles in the shadows of her mind.
even if she spent her entire life being so tenderly loved and protected by good men.
Chapter 54. Now. Let's see it one last time, said Christina. Ethan pressed play and they sat, side by side at his desk, transfixed by the jerky but clear colour footage from the CCTV provided by the neighbours who lived two doors away in the same cul-de-sac as the Delaneys. The camera had been smashed by a hailstone in the big storm 2 days after Joy had disappeared, and Caro Azinovich's son, who had installed the camera for his widowed mother, had been getting it fixed. He was the one who had brought police this damning video revealing a fisheye view of the front of his mother's house. It captured, accidentally, a pie-shaped sliver of the Delaney's driveway. Christina and Ethan watched Stan Delaney emerge from the front door of his home at 2 minutes past midnight on the day after his wife disappeared, struggling to carry an unwieldy, floppy object wrapped in a blanket to his car. He opened the boot of his car, dumped the object, leaned in to rearrange it, reached up with both hands to slam the boot shut, and then he stood for exactly 3 minutes and 47 seconds, both hands flat on the car, his head bowed like a man in solemn, reverent prayer, before he finally lifted his head and walked off camera. It was eerie and powerful to watch. "Jesus," said Ethan, "the way he stands there for all that time, it's so... my God." "I know it is," said Christina. She would get her confession today. She could feel it. She would play this footage to Stan Delaney and she would not say a word or make a sound for the entire length of the video. She would watch him, watch himself bow his head over his wife's body. She knew he was not a churchgoer, but she knew he'd been brought up Catholic, as had she, and she recognised the stance of a man in prayer, a man who longs to confess his sins. Tonight, she and Nico would go to meet their parish priest to discuss the holy sacrament of marriage, and she would try not to think about the fact that Joy and Stan Delaney had once made the same vows that she and Nico would make next spring. She would not think about a young Joy Delaney or Polly Perkins promising their husbands to have and to hold, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, until death do us part, until you carry my body out to the car in the dead of the night and dispose of it somewhere it will never be found, until I speak too loudly, until I spend too much money on a new iron, until I hold back your career for the sake of our family, until I kiss another man at a party, until I displease you in some way I cannot yet imagine.
Christina, said Ethan.
Sorry, said Christina. What were you saying?
He said, nothing really, just that I didn't pick it. That first day we interviewed him, I knew he was hiding stuff from us. But when he looked at that photo of his wife, I thought, no way did he do it. He loves her.
I never thought he didn't love her.
Christina adjusted her engagement ring so the diamond was centered again on her finger. But she'd always known he'd killed her. That was the cruel knowledge that she would carry down the aisle on her wedding day, along with her bridal bouquet of white roses and blush pink gardenias. It was possible for both things to be true.
Chapter 55. Valentine's Day. Stan Delaney had always known that women had the power to draw blood with their words. It was his mother's favourite hobby, to knife the soft, stupid, defenceless egos of her husband and her son. "Don't tell the boy he's going to play at Wimbledon one day. He's dumb enough to believe it,"
The two of you are as dumb as dog shit.
Not every day, just most days. Not when she was drunk, when she was sober. That's when she got nasty. She'd jab her finger at the side of her head and smile her beautiful smile at her husband and say, "The lights are on, but nobody's home. Isn't that right, my love?"
Stan's father had no arsenal of clever words with which to defend himself. He quailed and recoiled. He smiled stupidly as if his wife had made a joke that was too clever for him. He shut down and went silent. He took it and took it. He took it and took it until one day he didn't take it anymore. 14-year-old Stan ran to his mother where she lay crumpled and still on the floor, and it was good that he did that. He could always tell himself that his first instinctive response had been to run to his mother, to put his body between her and his father. But he also could never forget the first tiny, terrible, traitorous thought that came into his head. She deserved it. So faint, so tiny, he sometimes pretended he'd imagined he thought it. It happened so fast, but it also happened so slowly, and it was so long ago, who knew what he'd really thought at that moment? You couldn't rely on memory. It was an unreliable source. Stan was just like his father. He'd always known it. Not clever and quick like his mother. Not clever and quick like his wife. Not good at school. Thick as a brick. Not the sharpest tool in the shed. At the age of 70, he felt his wife's flesh beneath his hands as his father's colossal rage and humiliation, his pain and hurt, ballooned within his chest and exploded behind his eyes. Chapter 56. Now.
I think they're going to arrest my dad any day now, said Claire Gear's ex-husband, his eyes on the early morning glitter blue of Sydney Harbour. There was a croissant flake on his lower lip, and something so childlike and anguished about the way he said, "My dad." They sat side by side with takeaway coffees and almond croissants in white paper bags on a park bench overlooking the ferry stop where Troy had kissed her for the first time. She wondered if Troy remembered this, if he'd even deliberately suggested this location for that reason. Surely not. He had big, terrible things on his mind right now. Claire reached over and moved the crumb from his lip with her fingertip. "Why do you think that?"
"We heard the police have CCTV footage from the neighbours across the street."
He stopped.
"That apparently shows something very bad. I can't even imagine what."
His voice shook. "Jesus," said Claire. The coffee tasted sour in her mouth. She rested the takeaway cup on the bench next to her and looked at their bare legs, stretched out side by side in front of them. They both wore shorts. Their legs looked like the legs of a couple with a sunshiny weekend ahead of them. Not a divorced couple with seedy infidelity behind them and a potential tragedy in front of them. Not to mention an awkward procreation arrangement. Claire Gear was 34 years old. She had long curly red hair that everyone commented on. A world history degree that didn't interest potential employers or anyone really except for her father. He was a history teacher, and an unexpectedly fulfilling career in the US in health administration. Or not that unexpected, because she was the kind of girl who made the best of things, whose school reports and job references always mentioned her positive attitude. I bet you were a cheerleader, her new husband had said when they first met. And of course that wasn't a thing in Australia, and Claire couldn't even do a cartwheel, but she'd let him categorise her as a sunny, sweet Aussie girl. She was nearly the girl he believed her to be. She was a people pleaser, as sunny and sweet as an Australian summer. No need to mention the humidity or mosquitoes, the bushfires or hailstorms. She loved Jeff dearly, but not in the helpless, hopeless way she'd loved Troy. The point of history was to learn from it, not repeat it. She would have happily never seen Troy Delaney ever again, or even returned to Australia. The wounds had healed nicely, no visible scars, and she'd found a new life, a new love, so she could once again watch romantic comedies without scoffing. But here she was, in Sydney, sitting next to her ex-husband. She knew that Troy had only consented to her trying to get pregnant with their embryos as a form of penance. She'd seen the instant, instinctive horror on his face when she'd put it to him in New York last year. She also knew her husband, Jeff, did not want her pregnant with her ex-husband's child. He didn't want a family that badly. She'd seen the exact same instinctive, horrified response on Jeff's face when she'd put it to him. Both men were doing it for her, one out of guilt and one out of love. It was the first time in her life she'd asked more of someone than they wanted to give, more than she maybe deserved. But the truth was that she didn't think twice when it became clear it was her only option. She couldn't long for her own biological child and leave five possibilities frozen for eternity. She'd been in Australia now since last November, trying to get pregnant, while Jeff had stayed in Texas, except for a two-week trip at Christmas. It had been a strange, surreal time, the longest period in her life since she'd graduated, that she hadn't had a full-time job. She was reading and doing a lot of walking. She'd met with her ex-husband a handful of times, always for business-like coffee, and they seemed to have found an acceptable, companionable rhythm. She'd even introduced him to Jeff when he visited in December. It seemed the polite, grown-up thing to do considering their arrangement, but it had been weird and clunky, awful, really, and she could tell the two men hated each other. Both men had been at their worst, show-offy and insecure. But now Troy's mother was missing, none of that mattered. "I just don't believe it," she said. "I know I haven't seen your parents in years, but it just doesn't seem possible to me." She remembered the toast that Stan had given at their wedding. "In my profession, love means zero," Stan had said, champagne glass in hand, and he'd waited a moment to be sure everyone got the joke, nodding happily as all the guests groaned. Then he said, "But in life, love means everything. Love wins the match. I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, but I made the smartest decision of my life when I married Troy's mother. And I reckon Troy just made the smartest decision of his life when he married this beautiful girl right here. Don't ever let her go, mate. And welcome to the family, sweetheart." Then he raised his glass to Claire and sat down and kissed Joy, his hand at the back of her head, pulling her to him as if they were the young bride and groom. It was impossible to imagine that man hurting his wife. That man would have died for his wife. But then again, it had been impossible to imagine his son, with whom she'd been so besotted, cheating on Claire for no good reason. That's what had been so painful. They weren't in a rut. They weren't having issues. He didn't fall in love with someone else. He wasn't even drunk or high. He just randomly, arbitrarily, idiotically broke her heart.
unimaginable things happened every single day, and there wasn't always a good reason. Brooke has found Dad a good criminal lawyer. We know exactly what to do when the call comes through, said Troy. Brooke is standing by Dad. She said that even if he did it, she'll stand by him. Brooke says one moment of madness doesn't nullify a lifetime of love. But I think it does. I think it does nullify it. Don't you? Claire lifted her hands. You're in an impossible situation, Troy. Brooke and I aren't talking, said Troy painfully. You'll work it out, said Claire. It's all too raw at the moment. Dad never gave me an inch. He made a harsh, jarring sound that only just resembled a laugh. He can hardly expect me to forgive him for killing my mother. I don't think he would expect your forgiveness, said Claire. If this happened, if there really was a moment of madness, he would never forgive himself. Troy glanced sidelong at her. He was so angry with me for what I did to you. Ancient history, said Claire. It wasn't. Technically, it was contemporary history, a subset of modern history. She crumpled her empty croissant bag into a ball. A ferry sounded its sonorous horn as it lumbered across the water towards them. That's where I kissed you for the first time, said Troy, his eyes on the ferry stop. Don't, said Claire sharply. Sorry, said Troy. I just didn't want you to think I'd forgotten. They watched the ferry bump clumsily to a stop. The passengers emerged across the gangway. A savage-eyed seagull stalked towards them in the hope of something better than croissant crumbs. This one worked, said Claire quietly. He said nothing. She thought he didn't get it. I know it did, said Troy finally, without looking at her. Congratulations. I'm really happy for you. You know? She swung sideways to look at him. How do you know? I just knew, the moment I saw you. Something about your face, and you're not drinking your coffee. That's not why. It just tastes really strange today. It tastes strange today because you're pregnant, said Troy. It's great coffee. She looked with astonishment at the takeaway coffee cup. I can't believe you worked that out before me. I know you, said Troy quietly. He lifted a hand quickly, as if to accept a fair penalty by the ref. Sorry, I mean, I knew you. I once knew you. They sat in silence and watched the ferry heading back out towards the horizon. And the grief for what could have been and what could now never be bowed their heads. I wish I could tell my mother about this, said Troy. I wish I could tell your mother about it too, said Claire. She wished so many things were different about this moment, except for the baby, who would be cherished, who had been created out of modern medicine and love, reluctant, guilty, complicated love, but still love. Somehow it would all work out. She would make sure of it. Chapter 57. Troy thinks Dad is going to be arrested today, said Logan. What does Troy know? Said Indira Malik, and she realised she'd automatically slipped into the role of supporting Logan in the ongoing competition between him and his younger brother, although only Troy openly wanted to win. Indira and Logan sat at the glass-topped table where they used to eat dinner each night. She'd told Logan that she was here in Sydney for a friend's baby shower, and it was true, but she would never have flown all this way for an awful baby shower. She'd come for Logan.
"You're still in love with him," accused a friend as they cooed, "so cute," each time the guest of honour opened another gift and held it up above the proud, pregnant curve of her stomach. Indira had informed her sternly that her ex-boyfriend's mother was missing. She was here as a friend.
"How is Amy coping?" she asked Logan.
"She's okay. I think she's actually in a session right now with her therapist or counsellor or whatever we're meant to call him," said Logan.
"That's good," said Indira. "She should probably..."
She stopped herself. She was no longer a part of the Delaney family and therefore no longer entitled to an opinion about how Amy should manage her mental health. Amy had once told Indira that she was pigeonholed because she was easily offended when she was a child, and now everyone assumed she was still easily offended, which was offensive. Indira had sympathised because she too was pigeonholed by her family as the clumsy one, even though she was no longer especially clumsy. She picked up one of the missing person flyers on Logan's table. It was too busy, with too many different typefaces. It broke her heart that she hadn't been the one to design it. The photo showed Joy wearing a T-shirt that Indira had given her. It was screen-printed with three big gerberas. She and Joy had a shared fondness for the flower. They bought little gerbera-themed gifts for each other.
"Do you want any help putting these flyers up?" she asked Logan.
"It's okay," said Logan. "They're everywhere. I feel like we've done everything possible to get the word out there. She's just vanished."
Indira looked at Joy's smiling face. Logan's mother would never deliberately stay out of contact for this long. She was the sort of person who kept effortlessly in touch with everyone. Even after Indira broke up with Logan, Joy had continued to send the occasional non-intrusive text or email filled with exclamation marks and emojis. Logan didn't seem at all like his mother, but in this they were alike. He was good at keeping in touch with people too. He was the friend who went around to people's houses and helped build their back deck or fix their drainage problem. He was the friend people called when they'd locked themselves out of their house or when an appliance exploded. She should never have called him passive. Passive people didn't spend entire weekends helping their friends build back decks. He was a good person. She experienced the truth of this like a physical injury, a literal twist of the heart.
"Are you okay?" asked Logan.
"Don't worry about me," said Indira. "I'm worried about you." She put her hand on top of his. He looked terrible. He was always scruffy. Scruffiness was part of his identity. It was how he differentiated himself from his brother. That was her theory, of which he did not approve. But this was a new level of scruffiness. His eyes were red, his skin blotchy, his jeans sagged around his waist like an old man's trousers. He must have lost weight. 7 months ago, she'd broken up with Logan because she'd felt trapped, pleasantly trapped, but trapped nonetheless, in a perfectly nice life, living in this perfectly adequate townhouse, going to the same perfectly adequate Mexican restaurant every Friday night. It wasn't that she loved change. The thing she most disliked in Logan was the things she most disliked in herself. She, too, loved the seductiveness of a daily routine. Logan didn't chase her to the airport like a scene in a movie. Naturally, he didn't. But then, nothing happened.
Her life didn't magically become different. She was still Indira, just alone and lonely. She missed him. She missed sex. She had assumed sex was like chocolate. If it wasn't in the house, she wouldn't think about it. It had begun to occur to her that she wasn't trapped because of Logan. She'd been trapped in her own Indira self, like everyone was trapped in their own selves. What about Troy and Brooke? How are they? She could feel the question everyone was surely asking, unpleasant and sour in her mouth. Do you think your dad did it? Troy and Brooke aren't speaking, said Logan. It's like Troy thinks he's proving his loyalty to Mum, and Brooke thinks she's proving her loyalty to Dad. And you? Said Indira. What about you? Are you okay? I'll be fine. He suddenly flipped his hand over and held onto hers. She watched his face. A muscle in his jaw shuddered. He squeezed her hand once, tightly, and then he returned it to her, carefully and gently, across the table. She held the released, rejected hand with her other hand, as if to comfort it. Logan tugged hard on his earlobe. Are you happy? I'm fine, she said. You don't need to talk about me right now, not when you're going through this terrible thing. Are you painting? Am I painting? She gave a half laugh. I'm all talk and no action when it comes to painting. You know that. That's because you need a studio, said Logan urgently. Sure, Logan, said Indira. That's what I need. You need somewhere like this, said Logan. Just for example. He opened his laptop and clicked on a real estate website. What's this? Indira pulled the laptop towards her and her elbow knocked against the cup of tea she'd been drinking. Logan caught it before it spilled, with practiced ease, as if he'd known that was going to happen. It's a three-bedroom house, said Logan. It has a granny flat out the back. The light is beautiful. Indira stared without comprehension at the screen.